This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, all eyes are on Hurricane Irma and what path she plans to take. Both North and South Carolina have declared states of emergency. The president ends DACA and tells Congress to fix it. What our lawmakers are doing and the potential impact on North Carolina, which ranks 7th in the nation for the number of DACA recipients. Charlotte's mayoral candidates debate and make final preparations for next Tuesday's primary, and Charlotte's homicide count rises to 63. And includes a UNC Charlotte professor. Our roundtable of reporters joins us to talk about those stories and more. David Borax is here from the WFAE newsroom. Good morning.
Hello, Mike.
Kirsten Garris is a government reporter for Spectrum News. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Katie Peralta is a business reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you for being here.
Morning.
And Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, is also here.
Good morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook, which we are broadcasting on Facebook Live this morning, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, Hurricane Irma is a monster storm, the biggest ever recorded in the Atlantic. It's already wreaked havoc on the Virgin Islands and others, and the effects are likely to be felt here in both North and South Carolina. Here's North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper.
Wherever you live in North Carolina, whether it's the mountains, the Piedmont, or the coast, you need to take this storm seriously.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster.
Now is the time to prepare, because when and if I issue the order of mandatory evacuation, that means you must leave, and leave then.
We're going to start by bringing WCNC-TV's chief meteorologist Brad Panovich into the roundtable to talk about where Irma is now and how worried we should be, because Governor McMaster and Governor Cooper both said those things a day or two ago. He joins us now via Skype. Brad, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
How worried should we be in Charlotte and the environs?
My worriment level has gone down quite a bit, but you still need to be prepared, because we're going to see impacts in the Charlotte area. It's just a matter of severity. And yesterday with the track, it was a little bit more of a concern that we were going to have more of a wind and power line and tree issue. We could have gotten gusts close to 70 today and last night with the shift in the track to the west. And it wasn't a big shift, but the shift in the track to the west over Florida makes it over land almost the entire time it comes north, which means it's a much weaker storm, and it reduces those winds to the 30 and 40 mile per hour range with gusts to 50. Now you throw in some rain, and you know our area with all the trees, we're certainly going to have some trees and power lines come down, but the amount of that damage will likely be lessened.
And if it goes to the west of us, if the track remains as it as meteorologists and people from NOAA are saying, is there danger on the east side of a tropical storm from tornadoes?
Absolutely. That would be always a concern, right of the track or east of the track. You always worry about tornado threat. The one thing that works in our favor is the beautiful weather we have now. It's actually very crisp, cool, and very dry. So typically we have hot, humid weather kind of when these things move in, and that would give more of a tornado threat. The fact that we have this cool, dry air in place should reduce the tornado threat, but it won't reduce it to zero.
Category 5 hurricanes, and I think is it still a Category 5 this morning?
It's down to a 4 right now.
Okay, which means wind speeds of?
155 and going down.
But it was Category 5 for a long time, and in fact, I believe it was Category 5 for the longest time any storm has ever been a Category 5. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I've never seen a storm maintain that power for such a long period of time. That's typically rare. When we get Category 5s, they spike up, they'll weaken, and they'll spike up. They don't maintain that. It's like a sprinter. It's hard to maintain that for this length of time, but this storm did it.
And this is the strongest hurricane ever recorded in the Atlantic. What conditions have led to the creation of this monster?
Well, that's a deceiving stat, because it's the strongest hurricane outside of the Caribbean and Gulf, but it's not the strongest hurricane we've ever had in the Atlantic. That would be Hurricane Allen back in 1980, but it was in the Gulf of Mexico. So this was the strongest hurricane that occurred outside the Caribbean and the Gulf. And the reason that's a unique stat is the warmer waters are typically in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico. So to have a storm get this strong outside of those waters is extremely rare.
Wow. So this could be more of an inland, even a mountain event for the Carolinas if it continues on its present course. what will this mean for the mountains? Because if it's got high wind speeds, there are lots of trees in the mountains. What will it mean for the fall color in the mountains, which was, I think, predicted to be spectacular this year?
Well, that's a really good point, because higher elevations will have higher winds. That's the way hurricanes work. The higher up you go in the atmosphere, the winds are actually stronger. So you worry about places like Miami, those skyscrapers, the winds are going to be horrible at the tops of them. And as the storm gets up here, the higher elevations in the mountains will have higher winds than the valleys. Now, the good news, it's early enough in the season that a lot of the leaves haven't changed yet. But this wind could be so strong, it could literally just strip the green leaves off the trees, especially in southwestern North Carolina. I'm thinking area back towards the Maggie Valley, Bryson City, the Smoky Mountains, and that area southwest of Asheville certainly could knock quite a few of the trees down, but also rip a lot of leaves off those trees.
So South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, who you heard in the opening here, has said that if Hurricane Irma hits with any strength, with the strength it had on Wednesday, when it gets here, it will be like Hurricane Hugo. Are they in the clear now, given the current path? Is it going to be less severe for South Carolina, particularly for the beach areas, than Hugo was?
Oh, absolutely. Yesterday, if it stayed off the coast of Florida, the impacts in South Carolina would have been very similar to Hugo. Not as much up here, but down there, certainly. Now with the shift to the west, it being weaker, they're still going to have storm surge. So areas in Charleston, Kiawa, down towards Hilton Head, there certainly is going to be a storm surge even with this track, but it'll be much lower, about half of what it would have been yesterday.
Kirsten Garris is with us from Spectrum News, and both governors in North and South Carolina have declared states of emergency for their states because of the storm. What does that mean? What does it allow them as governors to do?
So it gives them more resources. They can activate law enforcement officials and agencies faster. They can put in they can say this area has to evacuate, and they can also set curfews, things like that. But it just gives the governors more power to say, hey, this is what we need to do, and we need to do it now. They don't have to go through extra, you know, red tape. They can just get it done.
They were certainly preparing at the coast. Were they preparing in the mountains, which is obviously where they need to prepare now?
I can't speak to that, but I know Governor Cooper has been doing daily briefings. He's expected to do one today at noon. So obviously a lot of people are prepping, and even our local government, Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts put out something yesterday saying that Charlotte is preparing. Now, we haven't been, I think, activated to take in evacuees or anything from Florida, but you can tell people are definitely coming up from Florida to us, but we also need to be prepared ourselves because, you know, we can't assume just because we aren't on the coast that we couldn't get flooding. Obviously, I think 2 years ago, Columbia got their historic flooding and they're inland too.
Right.
So I think everyone's kind of like, okay, let's be prepared. And obviously, all the images from Harvey are still ingrained in our head. I mean, you can't forget that.
I remember in the days before Hurricane Hugo came through, I remember talking, Brad, to meteorologists with AccuWeather off the air, and they kept telling me, you're not taking this seriously. You don't know what this storm is going to do to you when it comes through. If it maintains its present track, you really need to explain this to your listeners. You don't get it. And I said, okay, I'll explain. What don't I get? Well, I get it now, because what happened was devastating for the city. We were out of power in many cases for weeks in some places. Trees were down everywhere. Yeah. These legacy trees in Myers Park were gone. We're not going to get that this time, I take it, right?
No, two differences. It's funny you said that. We ran a story yesterday, too, where people said, well, it wasn't forecast to do this in Charlotte. As you correctly point out, yeah, it was. It was just people couldn't grasp that that could happen in Charlotte. The difference between Hugo and Irma, Hugo came in from a much different angle. It came in from the southeast. It was over open water north of the Bahamas, and it was getting stronger as it approached the coast. So it became a Category 4 right at landfall. It also was moving at almost 40 miles an hour forward speed. So it was able to carry the winds, you know, all the way into Charlotte, into the mountains, even up into West Virginia and parts of Kentucky, because it was moving so quickly. Now, Irma coming from the south and coming much slower and weakening at landfall meant that we weren't going to get those winds to transfer way inland like we did with Hugo. Yesterday, if you would have had a similar track as yesterday's track, we probably would have had winds about 20 miles per hour lower than Hugo. Still bad, but not Hugo levels.
So when will we in this area and places to the west of us begin to feel the effects of Irma?
We'll really start to feel it on Monday morning, and maybe a little bit on Sunday night with some rain showers moving in, but the winds will start to pick up on Monday morning, and the peak of this, it'll kind of crescendo into Monday night into Tuesday morning. So it always seems like hurricanes hit at night for some weird reason. But it's just, it's going to be that Monday night into Tuesday morning timeframe where the worst of it is the rain, the wind, and it moves out pretty quickly. We could have some lingering showers late Tuesday, but we'll start to see things dry out pretty quickly, and it stays breezy through Wednesday.
So I have 30 seconds, Brad. How should we prepare?
I would prepare like you're going to have, you know, a power outage for a day or two, up to three. So if, like, when we have an ice storm threat and you're worried about trees and power lines coming down and you're not going to have internet or TV or power, plan that way. That's really the way you need to think about this.
And hopefully you won't need any of that. Hopefully.
Absolutely. And you can save that stuff for later when we do get into the ice storm season.
Although Katie Peralta says that she's been to the grocery store and they've already raided the shelves in Charlotte. Is that right?
Yeah. Some are even limiting customers to one or two cartons or pallets per order.
Well, Brad Panovich, Chief Meteorologist at WCNC-TV, thank you for joining us on the Roundup this morning. I appreciate it.
Anytime.
And we will continue in just a moment or two. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Kirsten Garris, government reporter for Spectrum News. And Katie Peralta, also from the Charlotte Observer. There was a televised mayoral debate this week among the three leading Democrats, incumbent Jennifer Roberts, the mayor, Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles, and State Senator Joel Ford, plus Republican City Councilman Kenny Smith. The Observer headline read, "Sparks Fly." How so?
Well, it got a little feisty. I mean, hey, it was the last debate before the primary. And, I mean, we've been saying this all along. This was going to be a big race because you had three high-profile Democrats. They have name recognition. They have the money. And they're all going head-to-head for this one seat. But, I mean, they talked about affordable housing, obviously the Keith Scott shooting, the city's response to that, the high crime rate, and just where do we go from here? And, I mean, so far, it's been a pretty civil primary, a couple of contentious, you know, ads. But that night, I mean, attacks were flying here and there. And, I mean, Joel Ford had no problem attacking or criticizing Jennifer Roberts. Jennifer Roberts had her few, you know, rebuttals back. Even Vi Lyles and Joel had a few moments. So, I mean, people were, hey, they were saying, look, it's televised. This is the last chance we get to talk to voters all at once. We're going to show you why we want to be your mayor.
And Jennifer Roberts and Vi Lyles have similar voting records on council when the mayor votes, which is not all that often, but they have been in agreement on a lot of issues over time, and both have been reluctant to criticize each other, evidently, until this week on television. Lyles kind of had a slightly veiled critique of the mayor during this WBTV debate.
I wrote the first report to the council saying, let's do some things differently, systemic things like getting jobs, getting housing, and then working towards trust with our police department. I believe that we've come some ways. We've got our studies, we're working on those, but we haven't come far enough. I believe that we've got to work harder and move towards action. We haven't had the leadership that would help us do that.
Was that just about the aftermath of the Keith Scott shooting, or does it take into account other issues or events?
Well, I mean, I guess Vi Lyles would have to answer that, but I think what was clear was that she and Joel Ford were ready and willing to hammer Mayor Roberts again and again on the response in particular to the shootings. And also, they got into HB2 a little bit. It was interesting. I think you've seen this throughout the campaign from Jennifer Roberts is she's trying to also go against the National Republican Party. She compared Joel Ford to Donald Trump during that debate, so clearly trying to do that. And I thought one of the most interesting exchanges, though, was when Vi Lyles turned something on Joel Ford, which is he has said over and over that he is a state senator, he has a good relationship with that Republican majority, and as mayor, he would be able to do a lot of things for the city. And she, in essence, said to him, well, then why haven't you done that while you're in the General Assembly?
So. That's a great question. You know, Jennifer Roberts is the front runner, so an event like this and what's left of the campaign is all about the other candidates trying to find a chink in the armor there. The race here is really for Roberts to try and get 40%. If she gets less than 40%, then there's a runoff. And so anything they can do to try and put questions into voters' minds and possibly gain a little favor on Tuesday is what they're doing.
And the interesting thing about this is that this is an off-year election, and it's a primary, and the primary is going to have very low voter turnout, particularly if we have bad weather on Tuesday. Yeah. And so it could go to a runoff, which will have even lower voter turnout, and local local politics is what really affects people's lives, not the presidential election.
It's incredible. I was looking up, I think it was a 9% turnout for the primary in 2015, and then I think it was around 6% for the second runoff with Claude Felter and Roberts. And yeah, for some reason, people here and across the country are so wired and programmed to vote in the presidential election and ignore local elections. And these are the people who really dictate much of your day-to-day life.
And you're letting a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of the
44,000 people last time
to elect that leader. The Keith Scott shooting in the aftermath was a big topic of conversation, and it was one place that State Senator Joel Ford went after Mayor Roberts.
If you take a look at the hurt, the devastation, the cry, the anger, the riots that resulted as a result of those shootings, the city of Charlotte did not look well on a national stage. The last thing we can afford to do is to have the mayor call out the police chief and roll him under the bus. What we need in this city is strong leadership, leadership that is going to be responsive to the people, answer the questions, and making sure that we're listening and doing what the people of the city of Charlotte want us to do.
So Mayor Roberts used that opportunity to take off the gloves when it came to Ford 2 with a comment that seems to have gotten a lot of attention.
Well, I have to say that Joel Ford's characterization of my relationship with the police chief is about as fictional as his crime-fighting plan. And I have a strong relationship with our police chief, and we have two citizens die. Yes, I stood up for transparency, and I will continue to stand up for transparency, and we have made improvements.
Did she stand up for transparency?
Well, before she didn't, or no.
After she didn't.
Yeah, after she didn't, I'm sorry. After she didn't, she did. And that's what they're going after on. The other thing is, that comment in particular, I've not heard anyone from the police department or the police chief comment on this great relationship she has with Chief Putney. I thought that was interesting.
Was that the tone of the conversation between the two of them, Joel Ford and Jennifer Roberts, for most of the debate or just on that topic?
That was, I think, the most direct exchange they had with each other. But Joel Ford was doing more of the criticisms of Jennifer Roberts. And every time and then she would have a rebuttal or just say, you know, I'm not responding to that. And then Joel Ford would say, well, she's not answering this question or any other questions. So, I mean, they were going back at each other in their own way. But, I mean, it was a very interesting debate. But, again, I think you can tell, as David pointed out, this is the last chance to show voters this is why I need your vote. Because if you think about it, with Hurricane Irma possibly coming this way or the remnants of that hurricane coming this way, you know, strategists, campaigns, they have today and tomorrow to really get people out.
In fairness, they didn't know that. They didn't know
that. But that's in the back of their mind. They were gearing up for these next 2 days.
But you bring up, you brought up an interesting point, David, and one that Tom Bullock, WFAE, I guess he's our political junkie, a reporter, and he's running that Candidate Me podcast. He brought this up in an article he wrote on our website earlier this week, that this debate was a class on campaign strategy, but with a partisan twist. Why?
A class on campaign strategy. You know, they are looking for ways to differentiate themselves. I mean, one of the other issues that came up in the debate where, you know, there were some where they all agreed, you know, many issues. But one of the issues where they disagreed was on whether to raise taxes to do some of these things. And they went in three different directions on that.
And I think they each went in three different directions. I mean, nobody gave a specific answer. I thought Mayor Roberts, it was interesting. She said, I reject the premise of your question about raising taxes, saying that there's so much uncertainty. I would imagine that, you know, whoever, if there is a second primary or in the general, if she goes that far, she'll hear that one again.
But, you know, look, I'm a voter. I'm going into the booth. Which button do I push? You know, the candidates know that they need to put something into the voters' minds that says, this person is different. And that's what they were trying to do in that debate. And that's what they've been trying to do with their emails and mailings and all that.
So early voting has been underway for a while. And this past week, they opened up additional locations for early voting. Early voting ends tomorrow. It includes tomorrow, but it ends tomorrow. And the election is Tuesday. What do we know about turnout at these early voting polling places?
Well, because I love numbers only during this time of the year, so far more than 6,000 people have voted early, and that is as of this morning. So again, we have two more days, but the big push is a lot of people do like to wait till election day to vote. But like I said, now with a potential hurricane coming, you can see a lot of campaign strategists saying, hey, come out to vote early. Even the State Board of Elections is encouraging people to vote early. And even I know Mayor Roberts put out a last minute campaign event today where she's voting early one more time. Well, she's not voting again, but more encouraging people
election
to vote.
Fraud. There's
just kidding.
Fraud.
And no alternative facts here. Sorry.
Breaking.
Kirsten, I'm a numbers junkie like you, and I've been following the early voting stats, and they're actually not comparable to the last time because, remember, we only had 7 days the last time. And so with the way that the expanded voting happened last year, you really can't put the two together. So it's a little hard to tell where we are.
So we must talk about the Republicans. And
which
the,
is
and
kind of how the format of the debate was, apparently. Yeah, we'll have
the
three.
Republicans.
Well, I was going to ask.
Yeah. I thought that was bizarre.
How did that work? Did Kenny Smith, the Republican candidate, the front runner, he's the only one that qualified. I'm not sure what made you qualify for this debate.
If you had an up-to-date campaign fundraising report, I think is how they sort of cleared the field a little bit.
So he was the only Republican that qualified. He's probably going to be the winner of that primary. Was he mixed in with the three Democrats,
no,
or was it completely separate?
He had a separate – so they went for 45 minutes, and then he went for 15 minutes fielding questions alone, which –
I mean,
I guess the way that works for him is he gets some spotlight time, but Then again, he has no one to play off or blame if, you know, they're –
Well, Republican Kimberly Page Barnett didn't qualify to join Kenny Smith, but she was in the news this week anyway with a Facebook post in which she said, quote, "Vote for me, Republican and smart, white and traditional." Pray tell, what has been the reaction to that?
Well, let's say the post is now gone. So if you didn't see it and get a screenshot, you're not going to see it now. But shortly after that, the North Carolina GOP chairman put out a statement saying that, you know, they do not want to suggest that someone's skin color makes them more or less qualified. And they basically, you know, condemn those actions. So it was a very... It was a talker. And again, you're right. She is not likely to win the primary, but she made news for something that you don't really want to make news for a couple days.
She said in the past that protests following the Keith Scott shooting were an expression of democratic, big D, democratic behavior, and that she doesn't think Charlotte should, quote, encourage more lower-income people to come here. We should attract higher-income people.
Yeah, I was at the debate where she made those remarks at the WTVI debate. She said a lot of things that have caught people's attention. I mean, I think those statements have to speak for themselves. What else can you say about it?
Well, in regard to what Kenny Smith had to say at the WBTV debate, did he differ substantially on a lot of issues from the three Democratic candidates? Would they have taken issue with him had they had the opportunity to speak in the same forum?
Well, I'm sure they would have taken issue. One of the things that I think is interesting about what Kenny Smith is trying to do is that he answered the questions about the reaction to the shooting and the protest by saying that he thinks the city and city council have done a lot of good things. Everything's headed in the right direction. But, oh, by the way, I should be in charge. So I think that's a little bit of a difficult argument. We'll see how that pans out going forward.
He also took a position that a lot of kind of middle of the road people have taken, even people that are, you know, against, for instance, HB2, by making the common criticism, you know, if Charlotte hadn't passed this pretty radical ordinance about bathroom usage to begin with, we wouldn't have ever been in the position to have this huge fight over HB2 in 2016 that we did. So, you know, I don't remember if he explicitly blamed Roberts for that. I mean, it is a criticism.
Well, he blamed the Democrats, and I think that, Katie, that's a good point. I think that we will hear that, assuming that he is in the general election. I think he will hammer that one home, that the HB2 problems and economic losses could have been avoided if the Democrats would have been more reasonable, I guess, in his opinion on that issue.
In terms of polling, do we have any feel for who on the Democratic side, because it's fairly certain that Kenny Smith will win the Republican primary, any feeling about which way this may go on Tuesday?
I have not seen any independent polling. Mayor Roberts' campaign has put out a poll, so obviously we
and
have
Joel's.
To. So yeah, and Joel's
campaign found that he is the best candidate, and Mayor Roberts found that she is the best candidate.
Surprise.
So that, yeah.
Yeah, so take that as you
I'm
will.
I'm going to guess that Lyles, if she does one, we'll find it.
Yeah.
But I think it's safe to say we could go to a runoff on October 10th. I'll just say that.
So the polls close on Tuesday night at 7,
we do, or six.
Somewhere in there.
It'll be an all-day affair.
How long after the polls close will we know who the winner is? Because if voter turnout is low, it won't take long to count.
Yeah, it's not going to take long. I mean, it typically doesn't because there's not, like I said, the turnout last time was 9%. It will not be a late evening. Mm-hmm. If you're working the election desk, it's going to be a good night for you, Mike.
If you watched the debate between these three Democrats on whenever it was on Channel 3, what would you have come away with? Have we treated it fairly in terms of the content of what came out of this in this roundup setting, or have we left out something that people should know?
Well, I mean, I think the arguments were just sort of solidified. I mean, what Mayor Roberts has said is that I'm for everyone. I'm for the people. I am already doing this job well. What Joel Ford said is I can forge a much better relationship with state government, and that's something that the city has lacked. And what Vi Lyles is saying is, look, I've been in local government behind the scenes and as an elected official, and I know how to do things better and more effectively. Those were essentially the three arguments I heard.
And I have to say that I don't think this election is going to be won on the airwaves. I think it's being won by organizing. And, you know, if you look at it, you know, Roberts has a great organized campaign. The other two are really working hard to try and match her on that.
And poke holes in either side as well. Can't forget that.
I mean, is it going to hinge on the mayor's handling of the Keith Scott aftermath, or is it going to hinge on HB2, or is it going to hinge on something completely separate from those
two?
We're
nearing the
issues?
Anniversary of Keith Scott, too, and you can't forget, I mean, even, you know, speaking from my perspective, we're doing a lot of work in the newsroom to, you know, do looking back on type of pieces. So I think that, you know, kind of a year after the fact, kind of reflecting on what's changed, what hasn't changed, will really put into perspective her leadership. And I think that it's kind of a coincidence, or not a coincidence, but it's interesting, the timing of this.
Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer. When we come back, the biggest story of the week, aside from Irma, was DACA. And we'll talk about that because we are the seventh most affected state in the nation, because we have the seventh highest number of DACA recipients living in North Carolina. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're gathered around our table at the Spirit Square Studio on Facebook Live and on your radio as well with David Borax from WFAE News, Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News. Here is what President Trump had to say to ABC World News Tonight anchor David Muir 6 days after Inauguration Day in January, talking about DACA recipients.
Should they be worried that they could be deported? And is there anything you can say to assure them right now that they'll be allowed to stay?
They shouldn't be very worried. They are here illegally. They shouldn't be very worried. I do have a big heart. We're going to take care of everybody.
Mr. President, will they be allowed to stay?
I'm going to tell you over the next 4 weeks.
So on Tuesday, 7 months later, the president's approach emerged when Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the end of the DACA program, which allowed recipients who were brought here through no choice of their own by their parents to stay despite their lack of documentation. But on Tuesday, the president continued to hold out hope.
Well, I have a great heart for the folks we're talking about, a great love for them. And people think in terms of children, but they're really young adults. I have a love for these people, and hopefully now Congress will be able to help them and do it properly. And I can tell you, in speaking to members of Congress, they want to be able to do something and do it right.
Is that true? Do they want to do it right? Or do they just want to kick this can down the road?
They are under the gun here. I mean, yeah. President Trump has done what hasn't happened so far. He's really put the ball in their court in a big way, and they have to do something now. I think this may be an opportunity for Congress to actually act on something that has been coming up every year for 12 years. You know, the DREAM Act was first introduced years ago, and it hasn't passed yet.
There are a lot of people who are really angry at the president for doing this because of the obvious consequences if nothing is done by Congress. But this is what he, not only did he campaign on this, he also campaigned on, I'm the guy who can get things done. And if this what it takes to get things done, this kickstart, essentially, really is a kickstart. Should we tip our hats to the president on this?
Well, let's slow down a minute. We haven't gotten the solution yet, but you're right. He is desperate to get something done because he's basically gone 7 months without getting something done. So if he can move this in some way, then yes, he's going to get credit for it. I thought it was really interesting that you had Lindsey Graham, you had Tom Tillis, several from the Carolinas talking about, a way to not only create a path, but create a path to citizenship. Well, and so there's a big schism in the Republican Party about
this
that.
This is going to be the problem, because doing it right, quote unquote,
define that,
means different things to different people. Here's Congressman Robert Pittenger.
You get a pathway to citizenship by entering this country in the proper way. We should respect those who have come in the proper way. And no, it's not arbitrarily provide a citizenship to somebody who didn't go through the rules.
And here's South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
The reality of the situation is that these children basically have no place to go other than America. And here's the good news for America. You should want them to stay. They're great kids. They're working. They're productive.
And North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis is also working on a bill. Now it's up to Congress. Can they get this done? Is this something that could actually happen? Could this lead either to some legislative means of keeping DACA recipients in the country, or could it lead to immigration reform? Well, everybody says it's broken.
Well, I want to know sort of, let's remember how the debate started. The president sent the attorney general out to make this announcement, and he hung this a lot on economic reasons, which were unfounded. They're just simply false, that the Dreamers are taking jobs out of the economy. In fact, they're adding to the economy. But that's all sort of a sideshow, because I thought the argument was entirely about something else, which was the laws and the security and citizenship. So where are we going here?
Sessions also hung it on the legality of president's order. But, of course, there's questions about any time a president enacts an executive order, is it legal or not?
Katie.
Going back to your question about Congress, because there is so much support from both sides of the party here, Paul Ryan even said that there needs to be some sort of permanent solution figured out ahead of the expiration date. But, left and right, we're seeing businesses speak out, too. Even in Charlotte, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, major employers who are saying that, not just selfishly for business reasons, these are young people that we employ, that we, that we depend on. But also it's kind of a thing these days also to speak up on social issues for corporations.
We have also paid to educate these people for most of their lives, if not all of their lives. And we had a DACA recipient on this program this week who is a graduate with a BA in English and a BA in Spanish from Johnson C. Smith University, spent her whole life here since she was three, never went to Mexico, ever doesn't remember it at all. So she's gotten a college education, and we have helped pay for this. And now we're saying get out?
Well, and that's
what's happening. And I know on Tuesday there was a big rally in Marshall Park. I think at least 250, almost 300 people came out there. And a lot of these dreamers, as they call themselves, said, look, we're out of the shadows. We are out here. We are doing what we can to make a living here to achieve that quote unquote American dream. We are not going to let you take that away from us. So they're going to fight back, this decision and make sure they get some kind of legal path to citizenship or some kind of protections, because they said, as you kind of touched on, they don't know their home country.
Right.
This is home for them.
Not only that, I think, Mike, there's going to be continuing. Let's just say that there is something done in Congress. There's still going to be the whole argument of the stress that you're putting families and people under for 6 months or however long this goes on.
Well, we did have a sheriff from Rocky Mount on the program the other day, and he is in favor of this, and he's in favor of the president. He met with the president on this very issue and said, these people, we're a country of the rule of law, and these people broke the law, and we need to uphold the law. And he does have a point, and there's a significant number of people in the country who believe that. Now, the Senate is more likely to do something about this or be able to do something about this because they seem to be more mature and less divided than people in the House. And Lindsey Graham literally has thrown down the gauntlet on this issue to fellow Republicans.
To those in the Republican Party who vote no, I respect it. Make the case that these kids don't belong here, because I'm going to make the case they do.
Is Lindsey Graham changing in some way, or is this just my imagination? He seems to be moderating. Is he?
I think Lindsey Graham, there's a reason that he and John McCain are best buddies. They tend to be be contrarian when you don't expect them to. And, and you know, he has made arguments that he thinks the president in some ways has made the right decision, even though he wants this law passed. So it's a winding path with Senator Graham sometimes.
Okay. North Carolina, as I mentioned before, is seventh in the nation in terms of the number of DACA recipients who live here. Many of them have joined the ranks of people across the country responding emotionally to this threat to their continued ability to live here. Here is a young man named Juan Diego.
To come and dictate whether I should live here or not, the only country I know, the only country I was raised in that have gave me so many opportunities, that has helped me out and become a better man and look out for my family. Why would someone dare to tear me apart from my 9-year-old sister and my 2 loving parents?
Is that kind of emotional appeal going to move the needle on this? Or is it going to help DACA friendly or people on the fence become more friendly to DACA recipients and get involved in talking to Congress?
I think people who are favoring some sort of permanent solution are using every piece of every weapon they can, I guess that's the right word, to fight for this. You know, whether it's an emotional plea, whether it's a financial one. You know, the U.S. would lose billions in Medicare and Social Security contributions every year if these folks were to leave.
But wait, they don't pay taxes, we are told repeatedly.
Again, I think that when the administration made that decision earlier in the week, there wasn't a fully crafted and factual discussion about exactly what would happen. And
you talked, Katie, a minute ago about the major corporations who have come forward and made the case for keeping these people in the country. And I'm sure there are lots of small corporations that employ these folks, too, who don't have the heft of Bank of America or Wells Fargo, but would also say the same thing. What would we have the seventh largest number of DACA recipients. What would the impact be if they leave?
Well,
to North Carolina.
Well, there's 27,000, to put a number on it. It's a lot smaller than someplace like California, which is 223,000. But there are DACA students in every high school here. There are DACA students at Davidson College, UNC Charlotte.
There are DACA teachers.
There are other people here in the same boat. And, you know, so there would be a hole left if they were suddenly all kicked out of the country. And that's why I think it'll be hard for many Republicans, and this is up to the Republicans ultimately, it'll be hard for them to be the one who said, I kicked you out. You know, they don't want to be that person.
There was a number used by Congresswoman Alma Adams this week, $1.2 billion, I think, that the Dreamers contribute to the North Carolina economy each year. I don't know the origin of that number, though, so I'm not sure.
The exact number is probably not important, but it is true that these people are their working jobs. I met a guy the other day who he made it through Charlotte Mecklenburg schools. He went to college. He's got a job. He runs his own company now. I mean, these are people contributing to the economy. That's the point.
This is certainly a legal and a constitutional issue, it seems to me, but it's also a moral issue, which trumps the other, and no pun intended.
I think we'll see in 6 months, honestly. I mean, that's
Does the Congress have time to do this in 6 months? They have a lot on their plate.
Yeah,
over the next
healthcare.
6 months.
I mean, they haven't done anything on healthcare.
Tax reform, responding to storms.
Government shutdown. I mean, there are a lot of things that they're worried about right now. But I mean,
at the same time, though, I think we've seen when Congress actually wants to do something, they can do it fairly quickly. The problem is they often just get bogged down.
And you know, we've been talking about this issue, not just the DACA issue, but the whole immigration system being broken for 20 years, 30 years probably. And surely there must have been ideas percolating that haven't been acted on that they could just pull off the shelf and say, well, this might work.
Well,
surely
the bill that Graham and Durbin are talking about is really the basic bill that Durbin introduced in 2001. So,
which is why Obama issued his executive order, was they could not pass anything in Congress. He said, I need to do something here.
Okay. So we have a couple minutes left. Let's talk about something really local. CMS is floating school bonds in November. There are some people in Huntersville on the town commission who are not happy with this and, in fact, voted on Tuesday on a resolution to oppose the bond package. Why, Kirsten?
They said Northern Mecklenburg County is not getting enough money in this bond
package. We've heard this song before.
We have, and it is true. In this bond package, Northern Mecklenburg County is getting the least amount of money, but places like West Charlotte, a western part of the county, are getting the most. But when you look at the bond list, it's 29 projects, 17 new schools, and a lot of the new schools in West Charlotte, they were built in 1950-something. I mean, they are old. And I know when you look back at the past bonds, 2007, Huntersville, that area actually got the most money, and that was $116 million. In 2013, they got the fourth amount. So, I mean, everyone's kind of had their fair share, and it's not a perfect science. Unfortunately, it's one of those things, not everyone's going to be happy. Some will, some won't, but it's still not enough. I know I talked with our local Mecklenburg County Commissioner, Pat Cawthon, and she says, you know, that's what they can afford right now.
So the town commission has voted to oppose this. That doesn't mean that voters will oppose it up there, but that's what the town commission thinks. The Charlotte Chamber started a Vote Yes for School Bonds campaign this summer. They spent $300,000 on it. I don't recall seeing a single message that said that, but they took a sample of voters to gauge sentiment on the bonds and other key issues. When will we know in 15 seconds or less the results of that poll, Eric?
I don't know, so I can answer that very quickly. I do not know when we'll know because they didn't know at the time I spoke to them.
All right. So that's all the time we have. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, Katie Peralta with the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris with Spectrum News Charlotte, David Borax with WFAE News. Panther season starts Sunday against San Francisco, where they lost the Super Bowl. Very quickly, handicap it.
Handicap it? Let's just be optimistic and say the Panthers win 21-17. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Go Panthers.
Second emotion.
Thank you for the hour.
Keep pounding. There you go.